Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. America was born in revolution, but that's a long time back and way out of style. Still, look around today at economic crisis, hyper inequality, town halls and tea parties and government gridlock, and it's easy to wonder, where are we headed? One guest today warns anything could happen. Another, an esteemed historian, takes the long view of American populism and social conflict. This hour On Point, we're just thinking about revolution and the USA. You can join the conversation. Does American level-headedness kick in and prevail here, rebalance and move on, or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll hear in a few minutes from historian Lawrence Goodwin at Duke, a scholar of American populism and European upheaval. But joining me first today is Bruce Judson, a self-described ardent capitalist and entrepreneur who's writing now about have and have not inequality as a mounting powder keg issue in America, writing about revolution. He's a senior faculty fellow at the Yale School of Management, Yale's business school. His new book is It Could Happen Here, America on the Brink. Bruce Judson, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
So, I'm trying to put this picture together. So you're advising and lecturing Yale Business School students and blogging about the finer points of management at Citigroup. You call yourself an ardent capitalist, a patriot, a lawyer, a background in constitutional theory, student of democracy, prizes our form of government, but you're writing about revolution. What's up?
That's a great question. And let me clarify, everything you said is correct. I teach a spring course at the Yale School of Management. I am a successful entrepreneur, and one of the proudest days of my life was when I was profiled in the Wall Street Journal and a dot drawing. I asked the journal for the original art for that drawing.
So you're not a revolutionary. That's not a Che Guevara t-shirt.
It is not. And in fact, I'm a lawyer, and my constitutional law course was taught by Robert Bork, the former Supreme Court nominee, and I respect his principles, and I think we are a great country.
Why are you writing about a revolution? More than writing, why are you warning?
Okay.
You're saying this could happen, which I think a lot of people
say. So I am warning of it because we are at a place we have never been before. We are at historic levels of economic inequality. According to, as we look at the recorded inequality, we have never been this high in the history of the nation. America has never been a nation of rich and poor. We've always described ourselves as a middle-class society. When you have extreme economic inequality and a nation that is moving further and further away, and a collapsing middle class, and unfortunately, our middle class is collapsing. So first, we've got economic inequality. Second, a collapsing middle class. And then if you add to that a dramatic difference in expectations, where people expected their lives to be one way, and suddenly they are diminished, you can have political instability. That's my reading of history. Mm. That's my reading of what could happen to our democracy.
You're pretty determinist here. I mean, you look back at history and say you can't have this inequality without revolution. On the other hand, we've been around for a couple centuries and going now and haven't had any revolution since the first one. I mean, are things really so extreme that Americans are going to give up on the kind of, you know, this is a cycle, wait, the pendulum will swing, things will be fine, hang in there, that kind of core mentality?
Tom, that's a great point. I think two aspects. The great strength of America has always been, as you said, that the cycles, that we are a self-correcting democracy. There's only one other time in history where we approached our current levels of economic inequality, and that was 1928. At that time, President Roosevelt said, America demands action and action now. And we had some extraordinary things happen. You wrote about my blogging about Citicorp. Mm. They were not talking about regulating. The same arguments that were made then are being made now. The large financial institutions said, let us be large and we will behave and regulate us. Instead, over their opposition, those institutions were broken up in order to create a more dynamic free market.
You're talking the 1930s and the New Deal there, and this after 1928, whereas you point out, the concentration of wealth in the country was really extraordinary. In that year, the top 1928, the top 1% of American households had about 23.9% of all the income in this country,
which I believe is where we are today, something like that. Between 2002 and 2007, the top 1% of households in this country acquired 2/3 of all of our growth in income. All right. So effectively, if you look at the statistics, since 1980, the typical middle-class American has been waiting for a raise, while the wealthiest Americans have done extraordinarily well. And that was okay when we had this illusion of mass affluence. We had people borrowing, people saying housing prices are going up. The wealthy are doing great, but I'm doing okay too. And what we've discovered is that was an illusion. In fact, I would call it a great manipulation in the sense that we have had a mass redistribution of wealth. It's not the redistribution that John McCain talked about in his campaign. It's a redistribution upwards.
Okay, top 1% of income earners in 2007 households, basically right back at that 1928 level, 23.5% of American income going to the top 1% in that year. But, Bruce Judson, it's still the United States, which has had a lot of stability for a very long time. And you're
That's
painting
true.
Some kind of picture. I mean, most of your book is factual, it's history, but you've got a kind of a fictional scenario in here where you've got Americans for Economic Inequality turning into a domestic terror group and not only threatening but committing nuclear terrorism against this country. Americans doing that for universal health care and better income distribution. Really?
Right. Okay. First off, I do want to make the point that in 1928, when Roosevelt was elected, as you've read the book, people were seriously concerned about revolution. It was widely reported that one visitor to Roosevelt said, "Mr. President, if your program succeeds, you will be the nation's greatest president." And FDR replied, "If not, I will be the last." The farmers, who are, in my view, are the equivalent of today's middle class, did rebel. There were riots. There were penny auctions as the rule of law started to disappear. And what was a penny auction? It's when the bank foreclosed on a farm mortgage, the farmer got all of his friends to the courthouse, and everyone stood with guns and looked at people who were going to bid. And guess what? No one bid. Friends bought back the farm for a penny, and the farmer got his land back. Essentially, the law lost legitimacy.
But we did not have a revolution. We got the New Deal, and now you're painting a scenario of, and again, you say this is fiction, but it's right in your book. You're saying, you know, nuclear terrorism by domestic Americans in this country over inequality, Florida seceding, other states seceding from the country to avoid,
okay.
You know, really? That's what I'm asking. Is that really what you're saying is in the cards here or possible here, or are you just talking very, very hot politics in this country?
No, I'm not talking hot politics. I started this book in 2007. At the time, I started it longer ago, but HarperCollins and I agreed that the book would be published at the beginning of 2007. Remember, at that time, the economic crisis had not happened. People thought that my ideas were even farther out. We were not a nation that, today there's an article in the journal on anger, in the Wall Street Journal. We are a very
saying people
angry
are angry
nation.
At government and business. That's just about everybody.
Right. And why are we angry? We are angry because people feel the country is not working. And they don't know who to be angry at, and they don't know why. And my fundamental point is the reason they are angry is that we are no longer a middle-class society, and they're feeling it. They're feeling the loss of jobs. They're feeling that we are heading for massive foreclosures. They're feeling that somehow we have locked in wealth at the top, whether it's inadequate reform of our financial institutions or something like that. People are looking around and starting to say, this is not the America that I grew up in. This is not the nation I revere and believe in. Now, with regard to the terrorist scenario, you are absolutely right. The book opens with a fictional scenario to show how things can fall apart. We tend to think of revolution or political instability or whatever we want to call it as something that is planned out, that people plan out and, you know, is almost a Svengali-like Lenin activity. In fact, if you look at the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was a series of negative cascading events. No one planned it. It simply happened as one crisis after another took down a dysfunctional government. And this scenario was really just meant to show that that's to bring a reality home to that. Do I think that we are likely to see, I would also note, by the way, and this was frightening to me, that there have been reports that the recent terrorist, who, the recent capture of the terrorist who worked on Wall Street was a person who had tried to live the American dream and failed.
He'd sold pretzels or something on Wall Street, to be clear.
Well, there's also reports that he tried to lift himself up.
Yes, indeed. Bruce Judson, hold the thought right there, if you would. The new book is It Could Happen Here, America on the Brink. When we come back, we'll hear from Professor Emeritus of History at Duke University, Larry Goodwin, who's studied American populism and upheaval. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about American inequality, have and have not inequality as a potentially powder keg issue and a warning of one way or another revolution in this country. Bruce Judson joins us. He's a senior faculty fellow at the Yale School of Management, the business school there. His new book is It Could Happen Here, America on the Brink. And I want to bring another voice in right here, if I may, from Durham, North Carolina. We're joined by Larry Lawrence Goodwin, professor emeritus of history at Duke University. He's written about social protest and revolt in Europe and America. He's author of The Populist Moment, a short history of the agrarian revolt in America, and Breaking the Barrier, about the rise of solidarity in Poland. Larry Goodwin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So here's Bruce Judson, and he says he's an ardent capitalist, and indeed he's an entrepreneur. He's teaching at the Yale School of Business. He's got a pretty wild scenario of nuclear terrorism, but he also says in his book, for his purposes, extreme violence is not necessary. He takes revolution to mean, quote, the overthrow of one government or governmental system and its replacement with another. But that in itself is a pretty big deal. When you look around at American circumstances today, American sentiment today, American politics today, against the template of history, Larry, do you see, I don't know, upheaval brewing or something else?
Well, we're in a period of historic meaning. A lot is at stake here. There's no question about that. And Mr. Judson has written a fine book. It focuses on a topic that for most of American history, we've explained away generally with slogans packed with certain amount of reality that we don't have excessive income inequality in America. This book takes dead aim at that. It has massive amount of evidence of exactly where we are now and where we're on a path that has been laid down for the last 30 years. And it's accelerating, and he's worried. And I think that the book is bookended by a fictional first chapter and a reprise on that issue at the end of the book about revolution. And it's in the title of the book also. Mm-hmm. But the book basically is about inequality. I think what he's doing with his opening and close is an attempt to cut through the verbiage, the sloganeering, and the massive advertising by business, and the general orchestrated negativity about anything that the president does, to try and get above the din, the D-I-N, verbiage, and focus totally on inequality and see if he cannot help get something done. So I like the book.
Professor Goodwin, I have to say, I kind of expected you to be, with a historical perspective, the ballast in this conversation.
I guess I thought
you'd say, you know, this is pretty tough to pull off. American staff haven't really done this since the first one.
No, actually, we can kick over a few traces too.
Mm-hmm.
I simply don't believe that. I think revolutions, in fact, are organized. They happen no other way. Upheavals can have a certain life, and we had a certain kind of disorder in the New Deal, and we could conceivably have some again. We are in trouble. There is no question about that. But the historical platform upon which the trouble occurs is, as this book does point out, is a stable society in which one of the havens in the world you can put your money, if you have any, is still in U.S. Treasury bonds. So he's dealing with that, but it's because of our consciousness of our stability and our despair that stability may not translate into any kind of capacity to act at a time when we need to act that's creating the discord and the din and the anger and the levels of impatience that are spreading and have spread throughout the entire society.
I mean, I suppose,
or what have you.
I suppose din is one thing, but when you look at town halls and tea parties and angry blog posts and all the rest, do you see, from your study of history, do you see the makings of upheaval, of a change from one system to another, of anything like?
No, I don't see that. No, but I see a society that has gone from a reality of, it has always been presented in comparative terms. That yes, we have a few problems in America, but other countries have more.
Mm.
Or we have some inequalities in this country, but we're working on them. Give us time. The general tone is optimistic, and compared to other countries, America's got a few things going for it, no question about that. But he is. What our author has brought to this whole equation, Tom, is a feeling that I share with him and that we're all in this together. Now, this is a majority sentiment in the United States, but participating in that majority sentiment are people who've now been shocked into unemployment. It's rising. It's much more severe than one can get by reading the newspapers and listening to television. It's very serious.
Larry Goodwin, stand by in Durham, North Carolina. Bruce Judson, all right, there's an historian who's looked at solidarity and American populism and all the rest, and at the very least, he says, we've got big issues right here. But you do take it further. You say not necessarily extreme violence, but you've got an awfully violent scenario that you paint, dirty bombs going off around the country and Americans for economic inequality demanding change. Where's a flashpoint in your mind? If there were to be a flashpoint, you know, not just a din of tea parties and town halls and discontent, but a flashpoint, like what?
It's going to be over jobs. It's going to be over health care, too.
And housing.
Because health, everybody's got to breathe and got to try and make it. Health care is crucial. It's the great, second great issue in the whole culture and has been from the inception of the society.
Let me go to Mr. Judson, if I may. Bruce, I mean, those are issues, but where's a flashpoint?
Okay, here's a flashpoint. First off, we are on track for potentially 13 million foreclosures in the country during this great recession. That's one in every four mortgages. We anticipate... There are people that anticipate that one in every two mortgages will be underwater within 12 months. We are starting to see nascent things that people look at and say, huh, that's kind of cute. That's interesting. I don't know if you follow what people have called the credit card revolt, where people are starting to say, I am not going to pay my credit card bills. What's happening is The economic system is based on our shared belief that it is legitimate. And as we move further, as this crisis has deepened, as we are seeing people starting to stand up and say, it's not legitimate. I do not accept that these credit, I do not accept what the credit card companies are doing. And I find it hard to believe that if we actually don't have government intervention and we do foreclose on one in every four mortgages in this country, that something will not happen. Now, here's a flashpoint.
What does that mean? Why not just a big turnover at the polls? You're not talking just a change of party majorities here.
You are absolutely right. But I think two things. First off, here's a flashpoint for you.
Mm-hmm.
In the scenario, in the fictional scenario, I talk about, you know, the potential, how easy it is for people to bring radioactive material into the country. It is very easy to imagine that an engineer or someone else with the necessary knowledge who works on, let's say, medical devices and has used radioactivity to create a better world, to, in his view, to save lives, is laid off. You can imagine that he suddenly is facing foreclosure. He's an educated person, unable to put his kids through college. He looks up and says, who's benefiting in this society? In a capitalist society, it's supposed to be the people who create the most wealth that earn the most. Is that happening today? The highest paid people are, in my view, Wall Street traders. Yes, there's all kinds of academic theory about the value of trading, but fundamentally, that's an arbitrage activity. It does not add to the wealth of the society.
And you've got a scenario, something like that, where somebody's got a dirty bomb and pretty soon putting up internet manifestos on the back of revolutionary attacks demanding free education, right, and their own home free from vulture banks and free health care for all. Maybe. Bruce Johnson, hold the thought. And Larry Goodwin, I want to get our callers, many on the line here. Will in Sherburn, Massachusetts. Will, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I started reading Bruce's book, and it's very interesting. But my big wake-up call to the potential of civil disorder was watching Katrina take place and how quickly that place fell apart down there. You know, within a day, there was raping and pillaging and murder, and the government was able to do very little to control it. And it it took weeks for them to finally get it under control. And it was at that point that I really said, you know what, it is a possibility in this country if there were a flashpoint, and I don't know how quickly the government could rein it in. So that was a big sort of point for me. And
the disorder you saw sort of on the television and the reporting out of Katrina. Thanks, Will. Let me go to Lansing, Michigan, and Patrick. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
First-time caller.
Good to have you.
And hello, Bruce. I agree with your theory. I really kind of hope there is sort of a peaceful revolution. I think we need something to shake people up here and get their attention. I'll just make it brief. My wife and I are both working class, middle, perhaps upper middle incomes.
Okay.
Do everything right, drive older cars. They're paid for. Got a modest house, my first house that I bought new.
Yep.
Very modest. Pay my credit cards on time, do all of the things right, and yet I'm not getting any bailout help. I'm not getting any help in any way. I don't really want it, but it's like we do everything right, and we're not reaping any benefits. We're still treading water, economically hard to save money, a lot of money, what we'll need to be able to retire on. I think it's kind of laughable what is going to be expected in 20 years and what.
Right, so that's a tough road, but I have to say, Patrick, you don't sound like a pitchfork guy or certainly like a dirty bomber. You don't sound like a revolutionary.
No, not yet, but I have been saying for 20 years that I really think there's going to be a revolution because I think we're heading towards economic chaos. I know there's theories in mathematics about chaos and maybe in the universe, but I think financially the numbers just don't add up. I mean, even if we were really good about the economy in the last 20 years, just the fact that our population is aging so rapidly and we're losing really good-paying jobs and the infrastructure needs in the country with the highway system, systems. I just don't see how this can all work out. Bottom line, I think we're turning into Russia and Mexico. The middle class is gone, and how can a country survive with just poor people and very rich people? I just don't know how. It just doesn't seem to compute.
Patrick, you sound like a solid and welcome fellow citizen. I'm glad for your call. Thanks for calling in. Larry Goodwin, do you imagine, you know, a million Patricks and Patrices that along those lines really turning into upheaval?
Well, one thing we can count on is if we have any sort of rebellion out there, the government will act. That did not happen at Katrina, let me say. Whatever happened in New Orleans, it happened with the passive assistance of the Bush administration. I want to make that distinction very clear at the beginning. I simply disagree with Bruce Jetson on the probabilities of a revolution at this point. This expression of we need a revolution will increase. We're going to hear that. But actual revolution and preconditions are not here. They're not present.
What are the preconditions when you look at it as an historian who studied this, the required preconditions?
Populism occurred in the United States in the middle of a long period in which the mass of American farmers went from owning their land to not owning their land. And they were fighting for a way of life and for an understanding of their position in the culture. Now, that's exactly the expression that we just heard from the last caller from Lansing.
Yes.
He's done everything right, and he feels cheated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is a profound that's a profound moment in history when that happens. It happened to the colonists. They'd done everything right, and they felt cheated in being exploited by Britain, and it produced a revolution. But it wasn't spontaneous. It took quite a while. It was near term, near thing. And I don't see that now. I see the poorest people are most unlikely to lead it, and not that this book says so. It does not. He thinks it's the erstwhile middle class, the unemployed middle class, the foreclosed middle class, that will be the highest expression of discontent in the society. And that's a reasonable interpretation from my standpoint.
Bruce Judson, you've got a sympathetic historian, but he says the preconditions aren't sufficiently there.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. And thank you, Larry. And your points are all well taken. Two points. First off, I do want to say that I am not saying that I would like to see a revolution. I want to repeat that.
That's clear.
What I am saying is that I am concerned. With that said, it's very difficult to look back and everyone who, professional historians, anyone who studies history, and say, how do I use this to predict? But the broad trends I look at, which are very much in line with what Professor Goodwin was saying, is that if you have a sudden change in expectations, in people's belief about where they are in the society and the kind of life they are going to live, that is when you can have political instability. And in the book, I talk about a model which says, often people go into periods of reform, and we are in a period of reform now. If for some reason that reform fails and people suddenly wake up and say, you know what, I was counting on this and what has happened, it's not going to happen and my life is not going to be what I expected, whether it's material wealth or my position in the society, that's when you get problems. And there is the real potential that is going to happen today. There was an interesting article yesterday that said Americans still believe that their homes are going to increase at 11% a year. That is not realistic. Let me put it differently, Tom. I see the middle class, the American dream. People, it's an overused word, but it can be defined. No one knows.
Bruce Judson, hold the thought right there. We've got to take a short break. We'll come right back to the new book is It Could Happen Here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American inequality as a truly powder keg issue, potentially, in a warning of one way or another revolution. Bruce Judson is here. His new book is It Could Happen Here, America on the Brink. Entrepreneur, ardent capitalist, he describes himself as, patriot, lawyer, senior faculty fellow at the Yale School of Management. Larry Goodwin is also with us, professor emeritus of history at Duke University, joining us from Durham, North Carolina. He's studied American populists, the American populist movement and the Polish Solidarity movement very deeply, and you hear his openness today to what Bruce Judson's talking about. Certainly, inequality is a big issue. Let me get a call right here from New London, Connecticut, and Don. Hi, Don, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I think you should be listening to this this guy, Judson. You know, I'm an unemployed nuclear engineer. I've worked on 13 nuclear power plants. I know, making a dirty bomb is not a big deal. You know, I'm not going to go out and tell everybody how to do it. But I'm just saying, you know, things like that can happen. And it sounds like you're just being dismissive of all his ideas and what he's saying, because there's a lot of anger out here, and there are a lot of people who feel that the American dream is slipping away from them. They don't have a chance.
Absolutely.
And the only entrepreneurial, you know, opportunity for them is to sell drugs and to be an outlaw.
It's happening. I hear you, Don. We've got Bruce on for an hour, so I can't say we're not listening to him. But let me ask you, you've got a lot of expertise in your field, nuclear engineering, but does that mean you're unhappy if you're unemployed, or that you're, I mean, do you really feel like the country's ready to, you know, revolt?
It wouldn't, you know, I'm not an expert in revolution, and I don't really know how they happen. All I know is, you know, I'm 60 years old. There are not a lot of people who want to hire a nuclear engineer who's 60 years old. And there are a lot of people like me who are out there who, you know, once you have so much gray hair, you know, you're out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a lot of people that are just not happy with the way that the country is going right now. And I don't know how, you know, where it's going to take it, or what's going to be the spark, or what's going to be the event. But people feel like there's just no way to climb out of the hole, like that there's just nothing that's going to get them out. Just this attitude that I've seen over 60 years. I've never seen anything like it. So it scares me.
Up against it, and with an education, a particular education. Don, thank you very much for your call. Let me get one more right here. David, Sarasota, Florida. David, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Great show. I wanted to make 2 points. I listen to a variety of sources. I listen to NPR. I listen to AM radio. I listen to whatever I can. And this morning, I heard three people on the local AM station calling for a revolution because they're so upset and distraught. That was my number one point. So there are people out there that are thinking this.
But what kind of revolution were they calling for, David? Like Tea Party, anti-Obama stuff, or something else? What?
Well, they're basically just take back the government, bringing, you know, using the clause in the Constitution that we should take over the government that's not serving us anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they really sounded angry and serious. And, in fact, to a point where the AM host actually had to calm him down and kind of shush him because they were actually calling for, you know, get your guns and get out there. That was my number one point.
Mm-hmm.
My second point was how quickly this can happen. I lived in Los Angeles in 94 when after the Rodney King decision.
Mm-hmm.
And within 24 hours, there was 1,500 fires in Los Angeles. And the police force and the fire department, they knew that they could not control it. They were afraid to go put out the fires in the areas where this was going on. So they basically backed off and let it happen. And I think that's what would take place. They would back away, let whoever started it spend themselves, and then go after them. So, and it's also very real in a sense to me that I had a job where I made $98,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to nothing a year. I got laid off, and I've been unemployed now for 2 years. I used up my savings.
Yep.
I used up my credit card.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm facing foreclosure for a house that I actually owned at one time. So because I had to get another mortgage on it. So,
David, we've got it. That's a full report right from across the radio spectrum and from your own circumstances. Larry Goodwin, David raises an interesting point. I mean, so does Don, nuclear engineer, out of work in 60. But, you know, David saw Rodney King days in Los Angeles, but he's listening to a talk radio that sounds to me like it's kind of a right-wing, we've got guns anger here. And certainly there has been a lot of that. I mean, if we have a volatile moment, volatile from what part of the political or economic spectrum, Larry?
Well, there are two things going on here. Number one is there is an orchestrated, highly phony Tea Party rebellion that does not represent much more than the hardcore of the zanies in the Republican Party.
But how can you let me challenge you on that. They can be middle class, too. They can be foreclosed on, too, or worried about their economic. I mean, don't the same pressures hit Republicans that hit Democrats?
Those people weren't out there. They may get out there with changed minds later. But this was settled hardcore Republicans that are part of the, that man the Tea Parties. And historically, that's simply a blip on the radar screen. It's not important. The subject of this book, desperate inequality, and we haven't even gotten around to the racial disparity, which is far, far greater than has been publicized in this society. But
and I should say right here, if I may, Larry, here's a comment from Facebook from Janine saying, black people have known and felt the inequality he's talking about forever. I must confess I resent it's a big deal now because it's hitting larger numbers of white people.
Right, absolutely. And this ought to be part of the conversation. I'm glad you got the Facebook thing. I want to bring it up myself. There is this difference in the situation we faced at this moment. When white people, whether they make $98,000 a year or whatever they make, when they are suddenly laid off from a $60,000 or a $40,000 or even a minimum wage job, they do have family resources in case after case where they can fall back on, get help when, so that they're not instantly up against it.
Mm-hmm.
But for a very large percentage of the black population in this country, when they lose their jobs in an unexpected manner, they are in an immediate crisis. And the other members of the family have just been plodding along, getting by. They cannot provide instant help. So it's a much more severe crisis. Now, beyond that, there is a profound difference in the way white people and black people experience the American reality and always have experienced it. And I think that has to be part of this conversation. It's not a part of this book.
But we understand it as certainly a big and important and historic part of American life, and it's totally contemporary as well. Let me one more call. I'll come to you, Bruce. Marie in Somerset, Kentucky. Marie, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I do not fear revolution. I fear fascism. I feel that the comparisons to Nazi Germany are very stark, that the backbone of fascism was the declassed middle class, that the banks have consolidated, the big corporations have consolidated, exactly what happened in Nazi Germany. I could go on and on with comparisons, but I fear fascism, and racism in this country is so strong still, and anti-Semitism.
But Barack Obama's is the face that's having little Hitler mustache drawn on it at some of these Tea Party protests.
Barack Obama's reign, but I don't think he has long in office either. He's gotten 400% more threats than Bush ever got. I think it does show racism is still extremely important. And anti-immigration, the anti-immigration movement is extremely ready to fight and not against those who I think should be fought against, the banks and the big corporations.
Marie, let us pick it up. Bruce Judson, there's Marie in Somerset saying, you know, she doesn't fear revolution. She's thinking about fascism. While we're thinking extremes today.
Marie, we fear the same thing. When I talk about revolution, as we talked about at the beginning of this show, I talked about a change in our form of government. And in the book, I say that could mean the left or the right. Once you destabilize a system, it can go either way. So I fear a change for the worse, whether it is what we seem to identify revolution with kind of anarchy, and that's one possibility. The other possibility is that as people get angry, they become very vulnerable, as you pointed out, as they did in Nazi Germany, to demagoguery, to scapegoating. Those are all the kinds of things that we need to worry about at this moment.
But you've got hypothetical revolutionists in your scenario, Bruce, calling for, you know, free education and free health care. I don't think that's what Marie is expecting.
But I do absolutely say, you know, you can only, Tom, if you're going to create a scenario, fiction is great because it can help to bring ideas home in a different way. But you can only create one scenario.
At a time, okay? Anyway,
Right. I could have created a different one that showed people becoming increasingly discouraged and open to demagogues, to people who made promises, as happened with the rise of the Nazi Party. So I am equally worried about that. One other point I did want to make is Professor Goodwin's statements about race are absolutely on target. I entirely agree. The one thing that I have studied that frightens me as well is that the resources of the typical middle-class family today are far less than we generally recognize. The statistics, as I understand them, are that the typical family can survive for about 3 months with a loss of income. So one of the things I kind of say, I typically talk about is the loss of a job, a medical emergency, some other kind of event is essentially a sentence out of the middle class. We are witnessing a transformation to the former middle class. So the resources that we think people have, in many cases, they don't. They may not be as desperate as Professor Goodman rightly describes when we divide them by race, but they are very real for the limited resources, right or wrong, for the large bulk of this country.
Take a call from Boston. John. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to see what the panelists think about a potential scenario in which we have a re-intensification of the financial crisis, which most people agree isn't even over. And this time around, the government is greatly reduced in its ability to borrow money and recapitalize the banking system. What are their thoughts on what could be the result of that?
If we have another dip down, Bruce Johnson?
I have a very particular perspective on the financial crisis. I believe, and this power, wealth, one of the problems, the reasons inequality can lead to political instability is wealth typically leads to power. And we are seeing that today. And that powerful group then works to ensure their prerogatives. No group in history has ever willingly given up its prerogatives. So in my view, we had a moment where housing is the root of the financial crisis. A mortgage is a bargain between the bank and the homeowner. And what happened in the last crisis, in my view, is that neither party could live up to its bargain. Homeowners couldn't pay their mortgages. Banks could no longer meet their capital requirements. Had the government said, we insist that you meet the capital requirements, or we are going to declare you insolvent, and let's forget securitization, we would have, I cannot believe we could not have found a way to prevent the problem of securitization, which is what everyone said is the reason we didn't do this, then those mortgages would have been sold. And what would have happened? If I had a mortgage for $400,000, my home is now worth $300,000, and let's say my mortgage is worth 10 cents on the dollar because people expect me to default, other people would have bought that mortgage. They would have come to me and said, Bruce, this is your lucky day.
Yep.
I'm taking your mortgage from $400,000 to $200,000. You now have equity in your home. You can either make your mortgage payment, which is half, or you can sell it and make money.
Yeah.
And by the way, I, as an entrepreneur who bought your mortgage at 10%, have also just made money. I've made.
But
it's now worth 50%.
That's a scenario that didn't happen. We're thinking about what if there's a double dip or a long time in this trough. Our time
this
begins.
Is what, right. And if we don't, this is what we need to do, because it does not require us to recapitalize the banks. It does not require the federal government to spend money if that is a private sector solution. Instead, we have said the only solution is to spend government money and to keep spending it. And so we could have, and in fact, no bondholder of any bank, as far as I know, has lost a penny in this entire crisis.
We've got bondholders and revolution on the table, and our time grows short. Larry Goodwin, when you look at history, how do you see the way out of this moment of unease, to say the very least, that the country is in right now, that comes short of that revolutionary path? And we've certainly done it before.
The one perspective I could bank on, to use an awkward phrase, is that we're going to have a period of profound, not quite permanent, but long-enduring anger and tension between political parties and between classes as a function of daily life. Now, it will coexist alongside cooperation. It is not a good sign for the civil society of the United States that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is spending millions of dollars advertising in a fraudulent way, in a way that cannot be sustained beyond a soundbite, that this administration is now engaged in a process that's going to result in millions and hundreds of millions of dollars of new taxes and so forth, placing the entire weight of the business community against any kind of broad-gauge health reform. That is not a good sign for the long-term stability of this society.
There's the perspective of history from Lawrence Goodwin, Professor Emeritus of History at Duke University, scholar of American populism and European upheaval. Larry Goodwin, thank you very much for being with us.
I enjoyed it.
I'm afraid there's no easy answer at the end of this hour. Maybe a long road. Bruce Judson's new book is It Could Happen Here, America on the Brink. Bruce Judson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.